Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's their Democratic and Republican way to be a state comptroller. We reach the halfway point today in our election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Let other media focus only on the horse race and the attack ads. We are doing an issue a day right up until Election Day, 30 issues in 30 days. Today, issue 15, true or false, there is a Democratic and Republican way to be the New York State comptroller. Comptroller is a bland-sounding job, never mind the interesting MPT combination of letters in the middle of the word. It's a job that's more important than ever right now, however, with the state's fiscal crisis and with the former comptroller, Alan Hevesy, pleading guilty to corruption charges last week. That was a pay-to-play guilty plea for how he awarded pension fund management contracts. So we will talk to both candidates, Tom DiNapoli and Harry Wilson, and see who can save the state money and take control of Albany. With me first, the current comptroller, Democrat Tom DiNapoli, who was a state assemblyman from Long Island for 20 years before being appointed to the comptroller's position in 2007 when Alan Hevesy resigned due to scandal. Comptroller DiNapoli, welcome back to WNYC.
Ryan, always great to be with you.
And let's talk first about how you came to be comptroller. You're not running for re-election. You're running for your first election. When Hevesy resigned in December 2006, you applied. You were interviewed by a panel of two former state comptrollers, a former New York City comptroller, and a group of legislators. You were not among the three finalists deemed most qualified by the review panel, but you were selected by your colleagues in the legislature anyway. Is the way you came into office tainted by politics over professionalism?
No, I don't think so. The Constitution of the state requires that the state legislature fill vacancies in the office of state controller and attorney general. We've had three instances of that happening over the past few years, Oliver Coppell, Carl McCall, and myself. There was a process that many suggested was not only beyond what the Constitution required, but had some flaws in it. I think it's ancient history. I think the main point is that on a bipartisan basis, I was elected by the members of the legislature whose responsibility it was to evaluate the candidates and determine who, back in 2007, needed to take control of the comptroller's office, so you could take control of Albany as well. And, you know, the issue was really, as you point out, Brian, an office under a cloud, a scandal, predecessor had to resign. Someone needed to step up and clean up what was going on there. And, of course, after I arrived there, we found out there was even more of a mess than anybody had anticipated. So I fulfilled what I set out to do from the start of my tenure, turn that office around, make it credible and very relevant at this time where money matters are so very, very important to our state.
So let's talk about qualifications. Your opponent, Harry Wilson, has a finance background in hedge funds, among other things, and he helped do the GM bailout for President Obama, even though he's a Republican. So what qualifies you to do this complicated financial job overseeing the state's gigantic pension fund and audit all the state agencies more than your opponent?
Well, I would point out, first of all, I've done the job for 3.5 years, so on the job training is not required in my case. And as I pointed out, and I think one of the main reasons why I was tapped for this position, especially given the history of the office, I think issues of integrity and ethics and understanding the importance of openness in government, transparency, the kinds of skill set, I would argue, that you learn from serving in government, have an understanding about what government is about, was very important in terms of my ability to keep a focus on that area. Beyond that, the Comptroller's Office is a very an office of very diverse responsibilities. We hear a lot about the pension fund, but there's much more to the office than that. My experience chairing important committees in the legislature, government operations committee that has oversight on state agencies, local government committee that has had oversight over towns, villages, local jurisdictions. Those are areas where we do audits. Those are areas where we comment on state fiscal practices. Served on the Ways and Means Committee, the Finance Committee of the Assembly for 15 years. So So the various financial issues certainly are ones on the state level I've had a working experience on before I became controller, obviously even more so now that I've served. Another part of our responsibility is administering the state's oil spill fund. As former chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee, that's another area where I had an expertise.
So you've done this.
The controller's office, though, you look, the people who served as controller have always been people who come out of public service, and the task is, especially on the issue of financial management, the controller doesn't invest the pension fund money. You hire people with financial expertise to make the professional decision. So, you know, this is not a job where by definition you need to be an accountant or you need to have a finance background. You need to be sure that you keep your eye on the broad picture of all the responsibilities of this office, make sure you have a team of people in place who are the experts to do the various specific areas of responsibility.
You don't think it helps a great deal to have that kind of background so that the pension fund manager, so A, you know which pension fund managers to hire, and B, you can evaluate their work?
You know, again, I think people make a mistake to view this office as the pension fund office solely. That's a piece of a very, very broad mandate that has tremendous impact on state government. It is a question of leadership. When I mean, I'll make the point through this comparison. I'm not elevating the office beyond what it is. But, you know, the President of the United States is Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. Presidents tend not to be generals. Sometimes they are, but we don't take the position in this country, and I think that's been very good, that you have to have a military background to be Commander-in-Chief. What you do is you get to the leadership question. And that's what this office is about as well, and most public offices are. The person who's elected is accountable to the public, the one providing the leadership, the one setting the direction, the one setting the tone, the one having the people in place to be sure that contracts are being paid, payroll is being handled, audits are being completed, unclaimed funds are being handled, the oil spill fund is being administered, and the pension fund is being invested, and benefits are being paid out. There are tremendous responsibilities. To take one of those and say the controller should be an expert in one of those areas at the exclusion of everything else is wrong. You need leadership. You need someone who can work on all these various areas. Part of my strength is I worked in the private sector for 10 years before I came to public office. I have a degree in management from New School University here in our great city. I understand about keeping a focus, moving a team in the right direction, providing leadership, managing a complex organization. I think that's the skill set that actually distinguishes me from my opponent. And there's obvious other ways to distinguish. If you're going to want someone with a finance background, the hedge fund world is the least transparent, least regulated of all the financial services sector. And I would suggest the kind of risky behavior that part of our financial world is known for had a lot to do with the meltdown that we're still paying the price for. You know, just making a lot of money on Wall Street is not a qualification for being a good controller.
We're talking to both candidates for New York State Controller, Democrat Tom DiNapoli. Currently in the office is my guest right now. We'll talk to Harry Wilson, the Republican, next. In fact, on that last point you just made, in your New York One debate last week, you kept knocking Wilson, that seemed to be your main point in the debate, for being from a hedge fund. Do you think that actually makes him less qualified to do the job of controller, that he does actually come from a finance background?
I think it's less a question of qualification and more a question of what's the fit for the job. Perhaaps that is qualification. I think it's a risk. We pointed out one of the investments that his firm was involved with when he was a partner was in accredited home lending, clearly identified as a predatory lender involved in the subprime mortgage crisis that really began and affected the rest of the financial system that caused the great meltdown. And you know something? He made millions of dollars from his participation in that. I think he made only $7 million that year. So,
are you charging him with having done?
He personally profited from the kind of risky behavior where people lost their homes and where the rest of our economy has tanked and we're still recovering from. I don't think
someone with that kind of
background is a good qualification for this job.
Just to be clear, you're saying he profited from, but you're not accusing him of any specific wrongdoing, correct?
No, I think it's a question of the culture you come from. It's a question of values. He made a lot of money at a time that people were getting hurt by some of those investment decisions. He personally profited from it. I've always felt, I think many New Yorkers feel, those that were involved in the worst activities on Wall Street need to be held accountable. Now for him to having made all this money and take $3 million or so of it and saying, I'm going to buy the office of state controller as a state funder, to me, that raises a lot of questions.
In other words, because he's self-funded largely in his campaign.
Self-funded, and where did he earn his money, and how were those profits derived? You know, pension fund money, obviously, you want to invest to get the best rate of return. But when we found that we had investments in banks and financial institutions that were engaged in some of these poor, terrible practices that hurt people, you know, we've sued them. You know, we've been in court. We were the lead plaintiff along with New York City pension funds against Countrywide. We have other suits going on now against Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. We've been in active engagement working with first Bill Thompson, now John Liu, to get mortgage companies and mortgage services to change their behavior because we feel there's a responsibility to the larger community.
Mm-hmm.
When someone earns personal profit from investing in businesses that are engaged in that kind of activity, I just think it speaks to a different set of values, ones that are not a good fit for a public office where you need to look out for the broad interests of everyone.
But what you just said, does that mean you are pressuring companies who the state pension fund invests money in to do things that are less profitable for those companies and therefore for the state taxpayers?
Well, look, the kind of behavior they engaged in hurt their profits, hurt the sustainability of our entire economy, beyond the fact that there was a human dimension of people losing their homes. You know, clearly the behavior that was engaged in, if they were short-term profits earned, long-term, it was not a sustainable business model, and it was a business model that drove down the profitability of the entire American economy. So, you know, again, I think the Wall Street mentality, so the hedge fund mentality, is quick money, quick turnaround, quick profit, not the issue of long-term sustainability, profitability over the long term. And that's what a pension fund looks to. We're not looking to, you know, meeting a goal or beating our numbers on a day-to-day basis. We're not day traders. We have a long-term investment horizon because we have money to pay for the pensions of people retired today. It's the person who may be starting work today, retiring 30 years from now, that we are looking out for. So that issue of long-term sustainability of profits and reducing risk is what we're interested in. The kind of risky behavior and choices that were made on Wall Street hurt those companies, hurt those banks. They had to be bailed out, as we all know, by the public. We don't want to go back on that. My opponent opposed the financial reform that President Obama worked so hard to achieve. Was it perfect? Probably not. But it was the opportunity to try to put the kind of oversight mm-hmm. and regulation that we need.
Right.
He spoke against it.
And
I don't think you want to control us speaking against financial regulation.
Although he did work for the president on the auto bailout. When you talk about him coming from the sector associated with risk, in your New York One debate last week, Mr. Wilson seemed to propose being more conservative with the state pension fund investments following the crash of 2008, investing less in hedge funds and private equity and real estate. You seem to support increasing those riskier investments to try and make up the lost value of the funds. Greg David and Cranes wrote about this and said that you have increased these sectors to over 20%. Is that accurate, and is this the time for that kind of risk?
No, we haven't increased it. We've maintained a 70-30 split, 70% equities, 30% fixed income. We've done some changes in terms of our asset allocation of a little less in hedge funds, a little more in private equity. But we've not gone significantly astray of what's been our asset allocation. You want to have a diversified portfolio. You need to look at again. A pension fund is not like an individual, you know, investor. I'm 56 now, Brian. So if I'm going to make an investment decision, I'm thinking about retiring in the foreseeable future. How long would I expect to live? What do I need? A pension fund needs to be around forever. That means you could be a patient investor and you could weather, you know, down times over the course of decades. Investments like real estate and in more recent years, private equity have added value and return to the fund.
But would you describe
if you move to the kind of fixed income approach mm-hmm. that my opponent referred to, you will be billions of dollars underfunded in your pension fund. You will require billions of dollars in increased contributions. That means a hit on taxpayers.
Assuming the equity markets grow as you hope they'll grow.
Well, you know, they're coming back already. You know, real estate has been a particular lag at this point, but everything goes in cycles. And again, it is that long-term perspective. You know, people need to keep some of the simple numbers in mind. At the end of the previous quarter, not September 30th, we were about $128.4 billion. Our payouts in terms of benefits last year were about $7.5 billion. So we have way in excess of the money to cover our obligations. So when people hear, oh, the market was down, or the pension fund, you know, was a little low, or even after the great meltdown in 08 and 09 where everybody lost money, mm-hmm. we were not in jeopardy of having a cash flow problem or not having money to cover our benefits, because New York State, as opposed to all the other states really in the union, we're the best funded of all the state plans.
And
why?
So on that,
I was going to say, because we've had a strong investment return, and in New York, as opposed to Jersey and other states, mm-hmm. we meet our pension obligations when they're due.
And so on that long-term risk that you mentioned before, your opponent, Mr. Wilson, endorsed a sixth tier for newer employees to require more of them to beef up the pension fund in the future. At least in the debate, you were not pressed on that for yourself. Do you also support that?
Well, he wasn't pressed either. What does that mean? What is a sixth tier? What change would be included in it? We just started a new tier this year. You know, we just started a new tier five, that creates lifetime contributions, later vesting, caps on overtime, significant penalties if you retire before 62. New employees that are just starting this year are in this new tier. Mm-hmm. To throw out a word like tier six, What will Tier 6 be? I think Tier 5 is going to address a lot of the concerns that are out there. I know, you know, in Jersey, they're talking about all these great reforms they're finally talking about because they're so underfunded. They haven't met their pension obligations, unlike New York. A lot of what they're talking about is what we've done already here in New York. So I think people don't realize that Tier 5 mm-hmm. is a major change that was just adopted.
Okay. We're talking to both candidates for New York State Comptroller. We will talk next with the Republican Harry Wilson. We're talking to Democrat Tom DiNapoli, who currently holds the office after being appointed in 2007 to fill the term of Alan Hevesy, who resigned really under the cloud of scandal. In your opinion, is this about party and ideology on any level? Is there a Democratic and Republican way to be a New York State comptroller?
It's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, in broad stroke, there is a difference between being a Republican and a Democrat. It's why I chose, you know, to be a Democrat. I think, though, the Comptroller's Office has always had a history of being the least partisan of all the offices, because what you want to do with the office is talk numbers, particularly with regard to budget trends and fiscal health of the state. And it's the office that, you know, unlike the legislature, even the governor, that gets very focused on the battles of the moment. It's the office that tries to point in broader view, a long-term perspective, what are the implications of spending choices we make today, not just for today's budget, but the budget 2 years, 4 years down the road.
I'll tell you one reason I asked the question.
Yeah.
Mr. Wilson has been quoted saying that you have spent your time auditing charter schools, which should be encouraged. He'll spend more time auditing the state's expenses on long-term health care. Does he have his priorities right wrong?
Just the opposite. You know, charter schools, we were sued and we were stopped from auditing charter schools, you know, so we haven't spent very much time on that.
You were stopped
You know,
from...
there's been some reconsideration of that, but that, you know,
who stopped you?
Audits
who...
have been a very important priority. Medicaid audits, and certainly looking at long-term health care there is part of what we look at. MTA audits. We have spent, again, because of the court case, very little time auditing charter schools.
Do you see that as a Democratic and Republican way to be comptroller, picking out areas that each of you are more politically suspicious of to put under the auditor's microscope?
Well, you know, I do. Obviously, there are choices from my point of view, given the context of our tough economy and the tough budget. I think you need to look at the higher cost areas. So education, including at the local level, and certainly health care, and for New York State, that's largely the Medicaid program, those have been high priorities for me. We audited every school district in the state, finished that up in March, and now we're doing another round of 150 school districts. The MTA, all the issues with the rail lines and the subway lines, and the frustration with the MTA having money problems and always raising fares and cutting service or raising tolls, We have stepped up our audits there. We're also now doing a forensic audit on overtime, an issue we identified as a high priority. So my goal, and it's not a partisan goal, but it is a goal that says where are the high-cost areas, where are the services that have the greatest impact on the quality of life of New Yorkers, where can we make a difference by identifying ways that we could be more efficient, where we can root out waste and corruption. So I think that's less of a partisan perspective and more trying to reflect the reality of what has the greatest impact on the greatest number.
We just have 2 minutes left. Let me ask you two quick questions. One, what's the lesson from the Hevesy case?
You need to be vigilant at all times. That it was a severe violation of the public trust, the kind of reforms that I've instituted, and don't have time in 2 minutes to go through all of them, but more transparency, more openness, emphasis on ethics, banning placement agents in investment transactions, banning pay-to-play political contributions. But it's a never-ending process. If somebody wants to corrupt the system, no matter how you structure it, they can. The public needs to look carefully at who the candidates for controller are, and then the controller who's serving needs to be sure that there's appropriate checks and balances and transparency to be sure that something like that could never happen again.
And lastly, on the campaign, Mr. Wilson, as you pointed out, is a wealthy, largely self-funded candidate. How much do you expect to spend against him from now to Election Day?
Well, probably not as much, although we're spending a lot of time trying to raise money in a difficult environment. The lesson of all this, Brian, is we need to have campaign finance reform, we need to reduce the influence of money, and we need to have public financing of campaigns so that access is there for all New Yorkers, whatever their income level, and I think that's a way to promote greater integrity in the system, level the playing field, be sure that we don't leave offices, even high offices, only to wealthy people.
And just give me an estimate of what you'll spend in the next month or overall on the general election.
I hope we can get as close to $4.5 million as we can. So we'll see by the end what our final numbers are.
That's for the total campaign?
Yeah, total campaign.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tom DiNapoli, the sitting New York State Comptroller, running for election to the office. We'll talk to his Republican opponent next. Mr. DiNapoli, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian, as always.
And check out the Brian Lehrer Show News and Politics Quiz and see if you've been paying attention. We have a new question every day this week at itsafreecountry.org. Mayor Bloomberg wants to ban sugary drinks from being purchased with food stamps. This is today's question. Mayor Bloomberg wants to ban sugary drinks from being purchased with food stamps. How many other states currently exclude items from food stamps based on nutrition? All 49 other states? Just the progressive states of California and Massachusetts, or it's never been done anywhere? The Brian Lehrer Show News and Politics Quiz at itsafreecountry.org. Well, we just heard from Democratic New York State Comptroller candidate Tom DiNapoli, now the Republican candidate Harry Wilson. And again, this is issue 15 in our election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Let everyone else obsess on the horse race. We are talking about an issue every day until the election, 30 issues in 30 days. Today, true or false, there is a Democratic and Republican way to be comptroller. Mr. Wilson, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Mr. DiNapoli spent part of his time arguing that New Yorkers shouldn't trust someone coming from your hedge fund background, because that's the sector of the economy that takes the most risks and has the least transparency, and so is not where the people should want to turn, considering recent history, to manage public funds. What do you say in response to that theme of the DiNapoli campaign?
Well, I think that theme is really unfortunate. It shows that Mr. DiNapoli has only resorted to personal attacks throughout this campaign and, frankly, belies his lack of understanding about the financial sector, which is really scary to have in a comptroller. My experience is far broader than what he describes, and what he tries to do is use buzzwords to scare people. The reality of what I bring to the comptroller's race is really three things. First, my personal background, growing up in a small town in upstate New York, son and grandson of working-class Greek immigrants, and the first in my family to go to college. Second, my career in finance at four of the best financial firms in the country, two of whom Mr. DiNapoli has sizable investments in. Multiple billions of dollars of pension fund monies invested in two of the firms that I used to work at. And so for him to say that that is dangerous or a problem just really is either hypocritical at best and deceitful at worst. And during that period of time, I did a number of things. I invested in companies, which is what the comptroller does in managing the pension fund. I worked to restructure broken companies, which is why I'm running for New York State comptroller, to help restructure the broken operations of New York State. And then the third and final thing I did was I led the restructuring General Motors, which is the biggest turnaround in American history. And the skill set that I used there was the culmination of everything I built up over the course of my career. It reflected a deep set of financial skills as well as a ability to kind of work with management teams to drive towards a result that would improve the operations of a company, to work with labor on a roadmap to a better and more prosperous future.
Talk about that a little bit more. You're a Republican, but you worked on the auto company's bailout for President Obama. I guess that means you were supportive of that bailout, which most Republicans opposed?
I was supportive of the GM bailout. I did oppose the Chrysler bailout when I was a senior member of the team. And the reason I volunteered to work on that, Brian, was because if you step back to where we were in early 2009, the country was obviously in a massive crisis with no end in sight. And I felt that we needed more people of talent in public life, that I had a really deep skill set to offer. And I felt it was important to do that. And I felt that my country was more important than my party. And I was willing to cross party lines to do it. Frankly, I didn't really care very much about the fact that it was crossing party lines. I really just focused on the fact we had these very deep needs, and I thought I could make a big difference.
So do you think that's working out for the taxpayers? And more broadly, do you think the president's stimulus and TARP bailouts in general have worked out for the taxpayers despite their unpopularity?
Let me take it piece by piece. In the case of General Motors, the market value of the government's stake in GM is already in excess of the money that my team put in. It has not yet earned back all the Bush money that predated us, but I believe it will. But it's certainly already in excess of the money that my team put in. And we saved and, I think, fixed a great American company, including, certainly hundreds of thousands of jobs at General Motors, as well as ultimately millions of jobs related to the auto industry. So I think that was a very good outcome. I was opposed to the Chrysler deal because I felt that it was less likely to turn the corner. I hope I'm wrong about that, obviously, but that was the reason I felt that way. In the case of the stimulus bill, I obviously didn't work on anything else within the Obama administration, but I did oppose the stimulus bill because I thought that it was going to end up throwing a lot of money into a problem without a clear roadmap, and I think that's unfortunately what happened.
And you opposed the president's financial reform legislation, the banking reform, as Mr. DiNapoli brought up in his interview, and uses that as another indication that you're too close to the special interests in the financial sector. What was wrong with that bill, in your opinion?
Sure. Well, and Mr. DiNapoli, again, he either does not read my public statements or chooses to mischaracterize them, but I was very clear that the reason I opposed the bill were for three reasons. One, the overarching reason was that I didn't feel it went far enough and didn't address the underlying problems. The reason we had a financial crisis really comes to three root problems. The first was excess leverage in investment banks that left very little margin for error. Leverage in investment banks had been capped at about 12 times debt to equity up until earlier in this decade. And by the time the financial crisis was at our doorstep, it had soared into the 30s, more than 30 times debt to equity. So it created a very little margin for error and sowed the seeds for the problems at the investment banks. Secondly, Fannie and Freddie, which were had overheated the mortgage market, created the subprime mortgage market, and really sowed the seeds for that problem. And third and finally, a lack of skin in the game at both the rating agencies and the investment banks that were able to kind of earn huge fees without any repercussions for either inappropriate ratings or badly structured financings. Those are the root causes, and anybody who understands finance would support that. And the Financial Regulatory Reform Bill, unfortunately, didn't adequately deal with any of them. In some cases, didn't address them at all, like, for example, Fannie and Freddie. And that's exactly the statement I issued at the time the bill came out. And the problem is now we have a bill that's, I forget whether it's 1,200 pages or 1,400 pages, but it's incredibly long. It layers on a series of new policies and regulations that will be sorted out in the rulemaking process over the next couple of years, creates a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and stymies many other aspects of the financial services economy without addressing the core problems.
When you say stymies, I mean, this you're saying they should have been tougher on Fannie and Freddie, and clearly
yes.
It's a fact. Fannie and Freddie were not addressed in that bill, but they should have left Wall Street more alone?
No. I'm saying we should have focused on the core problems and dealt with those to address those, and not gone off into all kinds of other directions. By the way, there were some good things in the bill too. For example, placing derivatives on an exchange, which I'm an advocate for, and would have eliminated some of the problems associated with AIG. So there are definitely some good things in there. I just think it fundamentally missed the core problems of the crisis, and I think will create a sense of complacency that is dangerous. If you looked at the people who voted against the bill in the Senate and in the House, the single person probably closest to my position was actually Russ Feingold, certainly not some radical right-wing conservative. And he actually used language very similar to what I've used.
His position is they didn't get tough enough on Wall Street. Yeah. They didn't stop too big to fail.
That's correct, and he's right. He's right about that, and that's exactly my point. And my argument about Mr. Napoli, Mr. Napoli's whole point in this, I think, is part and parcel of his entire approach to this campaign, which is he politicizes everything without dealing with substance. And the substance of the bill is very straightforward to anybody who cares to focus on the problems of Wall Street. But it's easy to try to score political points and say, oh, I'm a Wall Street guy, I'm opposed to it, without dealing with the substance of what I actually said.
Republican controller candidate Harry Wilson, my guest on WNYC. We heard from Democratic candidate Tom DiNapoli just before. You said in a published interview that Mr. DiNapoli spent time auditing charter schools while you would go more after the state's long-term care budget. I asked him about this. Were you making an ideological point about what should be important to crack down on?
No, I was making a point about where the dollars are spent. And this is, you know, I think when you ask the core question of whether there's a Democratic or Republican way to approach the office, I would argue that there's a professional way and a political way, and that Mr. Napoli's entire approach in the last 3.5 years is a political way because that's his training and background. I think he spent 24 years as a politician in Albany. And my approach is a professional way because that's my background and training. And I think a professional approach would say if the comptroller is supposed to be the leading watchdog on behalf of the taxpayers, that he should focus on where can he make the biggest difference on behalf of the taxpayers. And that, of course, starts with the biggest dollars of spending. Well, let's take it piece by piece. The biggest dollars of spending are in Medicaid. And the biggest dollars of spending within Medicaid relate to facilities reimbursements and long-term care costs that are dramatically higher than the national average, roughly about 240% of the national average, and that those excess costs are both excessively burdening taxpayers, but also not resulting in quality care.
And he said essentially the same thing, if you heard that part of the interview.
No, I did not.
He said, yes, as controller, we have to go where the money is to find, you know, to audit the things that are most relevant to saving the taxpayers' money. So maybe you essentially have no disagreement on this.
No, I think we have a huge disagreement because he hasn't done it. He's had 3.5 years to do that, and he hasn't. You know, he may be adopting my rhetoric now that he's in a heated race.
Well, he says he's been auditing health care because there is so much money there, auditing the MTA, things like that.
Okay, did he
education?
Did he tell you how much money he saved for taxpayers?
I don't remember if he gave a particular stat.
Well, I'll tell you what he said. He's given four numbers in the last couple of months: $1 billion, $2 billion, $1.8 billion, and $2.9 billion. None of those numbers have any public backup to support them. And secondly, there's no evidence that shows that money was actually saved. He's published audits that may or may not add up to those numbers without any evidence of money actually being saved. And finally, in the scope of the 4 years that he's been in office as comptroller, the governments at the state and local level under which he has audit power have spent $1 trillion collectively over those 4 years. And even if you take the highest number he's put forth, of which there is, again, no supporting evidence, of $2.9 billion, that is a fraction of 1%. Now, there's not a household or business in this state that hasn't had to cut back on expenses and has cut back on a dramatically higher fashion than the numbers Mr. Napoli talks about.
So as state comptroller, you would be getting into every town and city and county's local budgets?
Well, first of all, Mr. Napoli does do that already. But I would, again, focus on where the biggest dollars are, and I think the biggest dollars of waste and mismanagement are at the state level, created by the legislature that Mr. Napoli was a part of for 20 years and that appointed him to his position. And I think that's why he has not been sufficiently vigilant in attacking those expenses.
But when you attacked him for trying to audit charter schools, you seem to be saying, hey, I like charter schools, we should leave them alone.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying two things. I'm saying that's not where the dollars are. they take all the dollars spent on charter schools in the state, they don't add up to very much of anything. And then secondly, that he was applying a different standard to charter schools than he applied to public schools. For example, he was applying performance audits to charter schools and not to public schools in the same district. So I think if you held them to the same standard, I think that's perfectly acceptable, and I think they should be held to the same standard. But applying them to different applying a different standard suggests a politicization of the approach rather than a professionalization of the approach.
You've talked about a plan to enlist an army of budget watchers to take control of Albany and try to cut spending.
Mm-hmm.
DiNapoli has said that would be overstepping your constitutional bounds because the comptroller's job is to audit the books and run the pension fund, not make spending priority decisions, which is up to the legislature and the governor under the law.
Well, again, I don't know if he just misunderstands what I'm saying or some other reason for him saying that, but it is clearly within the constitutional boundaries of the office to audit every dollar of state spending and then propose solutions on what's in the best interest of taxpayers. That's what the office is all about. It's up to the governor.
But is it your job to recommend, if I understand what you intend to do, it's to recommend particular spending cuts. Is that correct?
Yes.
Isn't that a matter of policy rather than monitoring the books as a neutral arbiter?
No, I think it depends on how it's done. Because I think there are questions of cost-benefit analyses that the comptroller has both the skills, has both the power, and in my case, the skill set to perform that would frame the policy debate. There is no pruning mechanism other than the comptroller in all state government, and unlike any business or household in the state. And the comptroller has the powers to go through and effectively seek to prune the operations of the state and make specific proposals. And I think that given that this state has shown a complete inability at any level of government to demonstrate the ability to identify improvements in its fiscal operations, I think that's sorely needed at Albany. I think the fact that Mr. DiNapoli thinks that that's inappropriate says everything that people should need to know about our respective candidacies.
We've got a few minutes left. As a Republican on the statewide ticket, are you endorsing Carl Paladino for governor?
No, I've been very clear from the beginning of this campaign that I'm not getting involved in other races, and I've said publicly that I'm not endorsing in the governor's race or any other race which would fall within the purview of the audit power.
I've heard, as a self-finance candidate, how much do you expect to spend total on this race?
Well, first of all, it's not true that I'm a self-finance candidate. I've put in a fair amount of money, but I've also raised more money than Mr. DiNapoli, even though I've done it with much tighter restrictions. I do not, unlike Mr. DiNapoli, do not take money from trial lawyers to do business with the pension fund. I do not take money from public sector unions that do business with the pension fund. Even though I've had much tighter self-imposed restrictions, I've actually raised materially more money than he has in the time that I've been a candidate.
How much of your own money will you have spent on this race?
I've loaned, as of the last public filing, $2.75 million, and I've raised, I think as of the last public filing, roughly $2 million.
I've heard a rumor that that's not as much as Republican leaders were hoping of your own money, and that you've got substantially less money to spend than those leaders originally assumed when they selected you for the race. Is there any truth to that?
You'd have to ask those leaders. I've never indicated publicly or privately what I was willing to spend, and certainly would never have indicated numbers in that zip code. So no one has ever said to me that they expected more privately, publicly, or any time during this campaign. So you'd have to ask them.
DiNapoli said the public should be concerned, in his opinion, with people who can come in and spend a lot of their own money and overwhelm other candidates in that way. Does he have a point? He supports public financing for that reason.
Well, I think public financing is certainly worth thinking about because I think there are a lot of aspects of campaign finance in New York State that are broken. But I think, in the case of Mr. DiNapoli, I think it's more of a function of incumbent protection. The reality is incumbents have massive advantages in the state simply by function of their incumbency. Mr. DiNapoli never earned the job. He was appointed in the case of a vacancy, and he has the ability to send out free mailings to all the pensioners and beneficiaries of the state. Now, that's perfectly legitimate and legal, but it creates a massive advantage for an incumbent. And as a challenger seeking to come in from the outside, it's important to have the resources to get your message out. I think if you adopt Mr. Napoli's approach, we'll be stuck with the same poor leaders we have in place today, and I don't think that's in the interest of anybody in the state of New York other than those people themselves.
You were campaigning on the fact before last week when Alan Hevesy pleaded guilty and that investigation ended, that the state attorney general was investigating DiNapoli as current controller as well as Hevesy as his predecessor. But the attorney general officially cleared DiNapoli last week. So are you totally dropping from your campaign any questioning of his legal behavior?
Well, you know, the primary focus of our campaign has always been about the problems of our state and my ability to make a big improvement on that relative to Mr. DiNapoli's. But we have raised these questions about the investigation because I think they're still unresolved. We have been asking for months for Mr. DiNapoli's calendar for the period of time between the time he was appointed controller and the time when he banned placement agents 26 months later. Why did it take 26 months to ban placement agents? It was clearly a massive problem shortly after Mr. DiNapoli became the controller. Who did he meet with during that period of time? We think those are legitimate questions that the voters need to understand. And he has, even though we've submitted FOIA requests to the letter of the law 4 months ago, he's refused to respond to them, refused to comply with them.
To the lessons of the Hevesy case, Mr. DiNapoli said banning placement agents, more transparency, more openness, banning pay-to-play contributions. Do you take any different lessons?
Well, all those things are true, but they don't go far enough in two respects. One, yes, pay-to-play contributions must be banned, but Mr. DiNapoli only banned them for money managers and not for trial lawyers, and he has retained a number of trial lawyers who are donors of his, including just a few months ago, one trial lawyer firm that donated to him in the second week of July, and he retained them the week afterward. That is the exact same abuse of the position and pay-to-play problem that Mr. Hevesy got in trouble for, or was ultimately, pled guilty to a felony over. So I do not believe that the lessons have been fully actualized. And the second piece I would say is that it's clear from the Hevesy example that we need better checks and balances. And I have a very robust proposal to bring in outside expertise on active manager selection that would act as a check on the controller. It's the first time that's ever been proposed by a controller candidate in New York State, and I think that's an essential reform that Mr. DiNapoli has not embraced.
And that is where we leave it. We heard from the Democratic New York State controller candidate, Tom DiNapoli, earlier. We thank the Republican candidate, Harry Wilson. We wish them both good luck in the election on November 2nd. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a call in, and you can start calling now, on the question, are great teachers born or made? And if they are made, how do you make them? How do you make a great teacher? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we'll use this short call in to help set up our online chat coming up at the top of the hour on the question, do we now know what works in education? So tell all your teacher friends, your parent friends, your principal friends about our online chat at our politics website. It's a freecountry.org coming up at the top of the hour at noon. We'll have the call in right now on what makes a great teacher. How do you make a great teacher? 212-433-9692.